Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about alfalfa pests in our spotlight. We'll take a talk about GDM looking to acquire Ag Reliant Genetics. In our Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of the sweep net. Cool Beans, That's Corny. We'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. You guys have a good 4th of July?
Yeah.
Did you watch someone blow up every guy, break out 10 fingers,
yep.
Watch someone else blow up part of America to celebrate it?
No emergency room trips, so we're all good.
It's good.
I didn't even light off any fireworks, though. Like myself. I watched a bunch, but didn't even light off. Lighted some sparklers.
I was going to say, no sparklers even?
Yeah.
Those things can be dangerous.
They Actually, what was more crazy is the bucket of, we put them in like a bucket of water after, and it was just, the next morning, the bucket of water was just red. The water was red. So I don't know what chemical would,
iron in there.
In there, whatever. But yeah,
check to see if anyone was bleeding.
No, it was fine.
I don't think I've went to a fireworks store and purchased fireworks
in a long time.
More than 10 years.
I know Matt has. Matt's a fireworks connoisseur.
Yeah, this year I didn't, but last year would have been the last time I bought fireworks at a fireworks store. So
you buy just the boring ones on the ground or Roman candles, or what's your go-to?
I haven't bought a Roman candle in a while. I usually get the like packs of mortars where they shoot up in the air. And
Matt's fireworks store, you get to like crack a beer while you're...
Really?
Yeah, they'll give you beer.
Where's this?
Sabisky.
Wow.
Sabisky.
I'm going there next year.
American Tradition Fireworks. Wow. Yeah, as soon as you walk in the door, you want beer, soda, water.
They want to get you liquored up so you buy more.
They got shopping carts for you. Wow. Yeah, it's a good deal.
Yeah, our village had to post on Facebook that nothing that took off was legal with...
Oh, right. No.
Right.
Wow.
Is it...
Oh, it's every city and village has that ordinance, whether they enforce it and how most people, you know, put them in the middle of the street, run out, let them off, grab them back or something like that. Or you hear some.
Judging by the sounds I heard at my house, I don't think
nobody
people were following that one.
Right. Yeah. Sure. I have heard farmers talk about that they're getting more requests to come somewhere in the country and light off. You know, like... Hey, you're out in the country. Can we bring fireworks to your place and shoot them off? Because obviously, it's perfectly legal and fine.
Yeah, as long as they don't tip over and
start shooting,
hit something. Yeah. Been there, done that.
So, where do you guys stand on drone shows with fireworks shows? We were at a festival that had it was billed as a fireworks show, but they started off with drones. And did the whole thing with drones, and then the fireworks happened behind the drones, and you could tell, like, the drones went till about, okay, batteries are dead, and then they
went down.
They landed, and then they finished with fireworks show.
It sounds awesome, this hybrid drone fireworks thing. I know Milwaukee had drone only, and it was a huge bust. Apparently nobody...
It was just the expectation of fireworks.
Right, and... And they just said that these drone things now, we're comparing it to explosions to basically, in their current drone show actually was kind of neat in some ways, but at the same time, they're using them now almost as like a giant screen. So the drones moved, but not very much. They basically put a whole bunch of drones up, if you can imagine, in like a one-dimensional sheet, which would be a screen, and then lit up certain drones to make
the fireworks,
make it animate and do things,
sure,
say things, do things.
Did they move or did they stay in the screen?
They did move somewhat, but in general they were just up there. They did move to, you know,
because the one I saw was 3D and they did a whole bunch of pictures
it would move that way too, but in general now they're using them kind of both ways too, I think. So we're going to have to defer to you on that, I believe, Bill.
It was cool. I think you have to have fireworks with it to be, take it to the next level. And I never counted how many there were, but there were probably a couple hundred.
Right. You're gonna need, you need a, yeah. a lot. Now.
The coolest part was when they like changed the lights. And I'd actually like having us having flu drones. I'd be nice to know like what drone are they using, how where the lights sit, how big are the lights, because they were all different colors. And we were at a baseball complex, so it was a little bit of baseball themed a little bit. But it was pretty neat on, and it was long. Like it was
sure you could make it longer 15 than
15 minutes of just the drones, and then another.
You get another 15, 20 of the fireworks.
Right? Because yeah, fireworks are expensive, and yeah, the shows seem to be getting shorter and shorter every year because it is that much more expensive. Unless you have a lot of sponsors to help foot the bill.
Well, that was one of the complaints slash. Benefits, but with the drones, then you can say your sponsor. Did they have any sponsors on the drone?
That was the cool part. Is I forget who I was listening, if it was Zabe or somebody else, but basically they said it was kind of like the Blizzard game
where they were throwing them in. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like every other laser little emblem they had on the thing was a sponsor. This wasn't. I don't even think they did. They had sponsors, but I don't think they even
didn't show them on the drones.
Sure. Yeah, I feel like it's hard to do just a drone show because even that's going to get old after like
well and like Bill said the batteries die the
popular like
right
they did one at the draft they do them at the Super Bowl and all the like neat thing about fireworks a lot of times yeah a lot of them are the same you know they're the showers or they're the different things but they can mix them up and they can do a lot of different things not that you can't do that with drones but
you're right Matt of like drones you see it once and it almost immediately the novelty wears off extremely quickly whereas fireworks it's such a staple of every year where it's like turkey at Thanksgiving you're not gonna
like you go to see a really good show where they have like the different shaped ones where they can kind of change the explosion and like you and I have seen them in the shape of a heart
yeah.
or
no,
different things at different events and like it's just kind of unexpected like maybe that's it. Maybe it's the you don't know exactly what you're going to see with a fireworks show. Where with the drones, it's like you got to wait for them to get in position.
Yeah.
And they light up.
It is like, and then it moves, and it's like this globe, or it changes to whatever else. And it was pretty neat. Just to me, the way they choreographed it and the different colors, you know, they could make things move because one drone would light up this color, and then the next drone would light up with that color, so just kind of like a light show too. It was more like a light show or a laser show,
right? Than comparing it to fireworks,
right?
What I think would be cool is if you could have them. You're saying there's a hybrid, but the drones went, then they kind of landed, then it was fireworks. They didn't like
they did both,
did they?
Yeah,
because that to me would be really neat too. Obviously, you have to have everything in position correctly, right. So you don't shoot down
blow
all
up
your
the drone,
drones,
right? Yeah, I think part of it might be the like level of excitement to disappointment with fireworks is a wide range because you don't know what you're going to see. You don't know how long the show is going to go.
Right.
Like, so your anticipation versus expectation, it's a pretty wide gap. Whereas with drones, it's like, yep, I can see them. And you can probably start to guess, maybe not with the screen side of things as much, but like a lot of times the drone shows they're moving into a shape and you can kind of try to guess what they're doing, and so there's not as much unknown in that scenario. I don't know.
Even a finale with a drone show, I feel like would be hard. Like fireworks finale.
That makes the whole show though, right?
Part, right?
Right.
Like you get it, boom, boom, whatever, and they do this and that. But then if you don't get like this whole big explosion at the end, it's like whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember there was because it seems to happen every year, every couple of years. I saw a news article somewhere, like somebody's fireworks, they accidentally blew them all up at once.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if the barge started on fire, but like the whole show basically. And the whole sky was just like lit up.
Just glows.
Yeah.
That is amazing. That would be fun.
I wonder how the
I don't think they did it on purpose, though.
How much we talk about drones and agriculture and profitability for, you know, and that's using them as spray drones and as basically camera drones. But this type of drone, how profitable those show, because you can't do like fireworks. If you're selling fireworks or doing shows, you can do multiple shows. You just sell them and they blow them up. And
yep.
yes, you still need computer setups to light them off, I guess. So maybe there's a little bit with that. But as far as to be a drone show person, you got like a couple nights a year that you can use these drones. I feel like it'd be hard, unless it catches on for other holidays as well, to use them. I feel like that industry is going to be...
We almost have to have a festival to go to, right? Like,
right. And I'm sure they can do that too. Like, there's other festivals, like you say, that they'd be able to do. And the good part with that is these companies are spending a lot on fireworks. So if they can spend half that money on your drone show and half on the fireworks or something, it may work. But yeah, I just, what the next step of these drones is going to be is going to be potentially pretty wild of the movement with this sort of screen thing and what it can do. Maybe it'll be so cool that we don't know. And then the noise factor, like it does, obviously fireworks, it's, you see it, but you also feel
and hear it,
feel it. Whereas drones don't have that. So I don't know how you recreate that either.
You just hear the buzz.
Right. Yeah. And that buzz isn't, I mean, it's
a literal drone. It's like, eh.
Right.
I think as they improve, like, I feel like the technology with how they swarm them and stuff, if they can do it faster, like, get to the point where they can move real
quick.
They're
just so fast, and they'll get to that.
I mean, the I don't know what the investment is on the type of drones they use. That's like Bill said, I'd be interested to know what they're all using, like, because for, say you need 200 drones for a show, like, are they $1,000 a drone? Are they, you know, $3,000, $5,000? Like, that's an expensive investment, and you're hopefully getting your money back. But, like, fireworks aren't as good during the day, but you can still do them. Drone shows during the day
would not work.
Yeah.
Right, it wouldn't.
It's like, think of baseball games, football games, yeah, where they do touchdowns and they fire off fireworks and stuff. And
Yeah.
I don't think we haven't quite moved to the point where drones are going to pop out of the end zone and make a little dance or something for the touchdown. All right. Well, at least we all have our fingers. That's a good thing.
Yeah. We made it through one more year.
That's right. I didn't this year, but normally I send out the Jason Pierre-Paul meme.
Yeah.
Wishing you a happy 4th of July. But, yeah. All right. You guys ready to get talking about alfalfa?
Yeah.
And not the little rascal with the crop. So, Bill, what do you got for us on alfalfa pests today?
Well, I mean, we're kind of second crop is pretty much in the silo bunker, right? Everybody's done with second crop. We're almost probably halfway to third, so once we get this time of year for us, we really start to, you know, obviously we have alfalfa weevils we worry about in first crop, but it's normally not a big thing for us. Alfalfa leafhopper is the big one, and then a couple others, so I thought we'd do a little talking about that.
Do you guys consider alfalfa a very, like, insect-infested crop that we got to worry about a lot? Just some of the articles I found about it say how, like, almost consider it towards the vegetable side as far as a pesty crop is kind of how they explain. So,
I don't really feel that. No,
I didn't either.
I think there are years.
Correct.
But not.
But in general, I mean, we've more often using IPM and checking them for bugs, we've more often not had to spray, I feel like, than had to spray. So in that way, it's a very good crop to be checking and using integrated pest management and sweeping and looking at how it is, because a lot of times you could tell your farmer, you're fine, we don't have to spray, is what I see more often than not. We don't have to.
I would say the seeding year is probably the most.
Correct. That one's the most necessary to make to protect.
Right.
So you're right. It's both more heavily infested, and if we leave it go, we'll have more problems later on.
Those leafhopper look that sweet, sweet, tender young alfalfa.
They really do. And it gets to a point now where when you're spraying for weeds, it's like you're sweeping and there's a couple, it's like, well, we better just throw it in because we're going across. I've had so many new seeding fields over the years where we just, you spray for weeds and then you come back the next week and you're like, well, this just exploded.
Now I got to spray for
bugs. I got to go anyways. So it almost becomes like, well, it's not the greatest IPM, but it's like, it's just something you do because you're going across it. And obviously with leafhoppers, that threshold is different based on the height of the alfalfa. So shorter the alfalfa, the less amount of insects you need present. I don't think I've ever sprayed a field that was above 12 inches. I don't know about you guys.
Rarely, no. I mean, unless it's a new seeding that may not be going to get cut for a little longer or something like that. But I would agree is once it gets 12 to 15, you got holds on your insecticide to harvest anyway.
Right.
And a lot of times even the book says, you know, just cut sooner.
Right.
If you got a problem.
Right. So I think we're to the point when we get that high where it's like, okay, we'll just wait, you know, we can get through the next crop. There's usually not a lot of pressure at that point anyway. And the presence of it is really high. So we're getting to the point of, okay, we're at 12 inches, you know, we got a week and a half. We're at, you know, one per sweep is the threshold and we're at 3/4, you know, we're probably fine. But I get really concerned, you know, between, you know, 0 and 6 inches is kind of where I'm targeting. Let's get these fields swept and let's determine what the pressure is. And, you know, at 3 inches, if we have 2/10 of one leafhopper in a sweep, you know, we should be spraying. So that is a pretty low threshold at that point.
Yeah, it's always, I guess, when I look at alfalfa, regrowth is the biggest thing. Like, is it hampering regrowth? Are we going to affect the overall growth of the crop? And that's usually in that early window where you're going to see the most effect of that. And weather plays into it too. I mean, you get a dry year and the hay's just not growing real fast. That can really prolong the period where the bugs have a chance to really make an impact.
When I teach my scouts sweeping, this tends to be one of the more difficult things is that the threshold's based on height, because I'll have them come back to the truck and, they're really heavy. You know, there's a lot of leafhopper out there and it'll be 12 inch tall alfalfa and they're getting 0.2, they got 20 and 100 sweeps, you know,
right. Well,
that's okay for that size. So I do try to emphasize that. Then say on shorter alfalfa when it's just stubble and they're, there wasn't that many there. I got 10 in 100 sweeps or 20 in 100 sweeps again. Well, no, 20 in
that size, like, is a big deal.
Yeah. So since it's size related, that is tricky in that as it gets taller, it's like less and less matter. So you're going to get a net full at that size and you may not even care or worry about it.
Right.
But a little bit in your net at short alfalfa, you better be ready to spray or have more apt to be pushing the spray. The other thing to consider is, and this was the UW professor, Brian Jensen, that taught us that it's not, so on first crop alfalfa where it's not cut, you can measure from the base of the plant that by height. But technically what he said, these thresholds are based off of length of stem. So say they cut it 3 inches and then there's regrowth from the side that's only an inch long. But a lot of times you'll take your height with your sweep net from the ground.
Right.
But he said technically it's the stem length
in
that. So that one was also tricky in that, maybe not at that 0 to 3 inch because it's just really small at that point and that's fine. But when you get into that 6 to 9 inch threshold, or 3 to 6 inch threshold where it's a half a leafhopper per sweep. Sometimes you think it's 6 inches tall, but technically it's only 3 inches of stem length. So one thing to consider there is that between that 3 to 6 inch length, if it's just a little bit more gray area of how you measure. And that's tricky too. I've had it where when scouts are on the field and the way they measure, see, like, will get different heights, and you know it's all pretty close to the same, but and there's usually a range out in the field, but there can be off by 3 inches that we got to calibrate ourselves at times because the way you take a height or what you're looking for, are you looking for an average or the tallest or what do you, or the shortest, but usually it's an average.
Yeah. When you get into stands with any sort of slope, your cutting height may not be even. And so you might have taller sections or shorter sections. So you got to try to do your best to really choose a representative height. And like you said, take into consideration cutting height. So
the biggest thing I have with scouts and leafhoppers is making sure that because they're so small and you don't see them until you see them.
Right.
Like you can't just say, go out and look for weeds right. and they find weeds and
bring them back
or whatever.
Yeah, leafhopper are hard to bring back.
Yeah.
Even hard to take a picture of because they'll jump around and
in the scale of them, they are so small that almost all the time when you show them, you kind of got to be like, no, it's that little speck. You know, they're smaller than the, like, especially like I almost use like the lead of a pencil as a, right. you know, look yep. for a green lead of a pencil because they're that small. And they kind of flit around, you know, they're very,
they like to keep moving.
Very snitch-like, if you will. And
thanks, Harry Potter.
Yeah, in their movement. So that's tricky too, is as you're pulling the net, pulling the sweep net out and
it's like you're
opening it up like a present. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. We're going to go snipe hunting in the alfalfa field today.
Yeah. And even with scouts, you got to, as they come back and tell you, some will either be very high or very low. And then you go, okay, they aren't seeing this yet. Like it is that a little bit harder that way. We're like weevil.
I think there's always this pressure that December scouts feel like, he sent me looking for something. If I don't find anything, right. you're going to be mad.
Right. I got to put something down.
There's a lot of them there. They're like everywhere, man. And I think the next pest you have on your list here, Bill, is what a lot of people confuse leafhopper for.
P-aphids and
the fifth horseman of the apocalypse.
is the P-aphid.
P-aphid. Yeah. And I always get the call after one cutting.
And this is why.
So many bugs on my cutter head.
Yep.
There's so many bugs on the cutter head. You got to get out here right now because it's like, and I'm like, okay, first off, you're cutting every inch of the alfalfa field and every bug that's on every plant has a chance to get on your cutter head. And yep, you're going to have 6 inches of yuckiness there. And 3/4 of the time that's P. aphids. And I said, I pretty much have to have my sweep net full of those suckers before we even think about it. And that threshold is 100 per sweep. So if you're doing 100 sweeps, like it's 100,000
right
bugs you have to count. No one's first off, no one's doing that.
I agree with you. 10, that's 000, a good sorry, way to yeah. say it, Matt. Of the that looks apocalyptic when you see them.
Yes, it's always like exactly what Bill said. You know, the cutter bar was just crawling. It's like, yeah, those are P aphids. It's fine. Like.
It's 10,000. Sorry, I added a zero there. That's 10,000 in your sweep net. You know, I always say you have to have like a manure cup full of those, and I don't know that I've ever done that.
We've gotten there have been years where there's a lot of P. aphids at certain times where it's like close to like, ooh, should I be thinking about this or not? But I would say
years.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty rare, if ever, that I've sprayed solely because of P. aphids.
What I always think is ironic about it is you're not going to see leafhopper or weevil on your cutter bar, especially leafhopper. And those are the ones that we really do got to be worried about, is more the leafhopper than a P. aphid. Not that it's just you need a lot of P. aphid, and usually the way a lot of times we get enough lady beetle with the P. aphid too to kind of take right. care of that population in general. Yep. So yep. What's the, Matt, it's the bad guy in Iron Man 3 would be the Mandarin, right? And
yep.
basically all movie you thought it was like this, he was sort of
the
a
bait
fake,
and switch.
Right. Yeah, it was like this fake bad guy that you didn't realize till later in the movie when he sees him and he was just sort of this character played on.
Yeah, it was an actor playing
this bad guy, and that's what I feel the P. aphid is at times, where, like you say, it looks so bad on the cutter bar, it will freak you out. But next week we're going to have Ag agent Kevin Jarek on the show, and I'd like to ask him if he's ever done a study of the protein value of a PAFID. And if the, like, you get...
So we should be mashing them up.
I don't know that...
Mixing them in.
And I don't know how much make it through harvest necessarily, but I would think a fair amount. And I swear to you that the damage that they do versus what they could potentially bring for protein probably masks it out in some way or something like that. So, again, they're a pest. We do got to worry about them if they are at that threshold, but it takes a lot of... I mean, it's like handfuls
right.
of them in the sweep net to really start to be worrying about them. That one, too, in general, is really hard. Like you said, Bill, it's 100 per sweep. Well, we're talking... You can't count to thousands when you're doing, say, a set of 25 sweeps. So I, in general, to tell my scouts, if we get like a golf ball size of them, we're not going to worry about them. If we get a softball amount in the net,
yeah,
then I, for sure, they're a problem. And then maybe in the baseball range in the net. If they're in baseball range, then we got to talk about them too. Do we got other pests there? Do we have other things to worry about? But yeah, I'm assuming you're not making them count every PAFID.
No. And usually you get,
just give me
a couple dozen.
A hand lens and a
right.
sweep net. I'll be back in 6 hours. Good luck.
Count them all, please. I want the specific number that you get in this net.
Yeah.
I think that's the bigger thing, and maybe this whole topic is, what do we get? When do we decide to spray based on, like, compounding? When does the compounding effect come into play?
Sure.
I would agree with you on that, Bill. It's not technically how this works, and it'd be hard for university or whoever to make thresholds based on the additional effect of them. However, if leafhopper are at half threshold and PAFID are at half threshold, it probably is one where you could say 50 plus 50...
Does that equal 100, even if it's not the same 50?
And again, there's how far are you till cutting, what's the weather, is it too dry, all that stuff kind of added.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors.
Right. And kind of figuring out, maybe I should spray. Even lately, one I've been adding in is the talking to the nutritionist and what cutting schedule are they on. Are they on some of these now are cutting in 25 days. Or are they cutting for beef feed and it's 40 days? It's a huge difference there. I mean, I probably are normal dairy rotations between 28 and 32 days. So the seeing where you're at in that schedule as well. So I agree with you, Bill. There is a compounding effect, and it probably takes a little bit more art than science there to get that right.
And I think weather has a bit, how much feed you have in the pile, state, like height of the crop, probably are a big factor in that as well. If you're short of hay, maybe you're going to pull that plug a little sooner and get those sprayed so you can conserve all the yield that you have. If it's dry, like you said, Todd, I've got guys that, well, it's dry. Why do I bother? Because it's dry. It's not going to grow anyway. And I tell them, well, we can't control the rain, but we can control that these pests aren't out there making the problem worse. So why don't we take care of that? And then, of course, we talked a minute ago about height. If it's you got a lot of PAFIDs and a decent amount of leafhoppers, but the hay is really tall, well, probably not worth our time running everything over to take care of it. Plant bugs can be an issue too. I really have never seen that be a problem, but it can be. I would imagine maybe in the western or southern states where it's warmer,
yeah,
they could have some of those issues. Though that's, if you get 3 per sweep in 0 to 3 inch alfalfa, and as far as plant bugs go, then you should start treating. And then if you get 5 or more in per sweep above 3 inches, that's kind of that threshold. And then spittle bugs, it's 1 per stem, which that's just got to be amazing. To have that many,
I just want to see that, yeah.
Because you'll see one or two as you just walk,
yeah.
But the threshold is literally 1 per stem, so that's amazing. If you had that many,
yeah. And then in dry years, sometimes, like I remember 2012 in particular, you get oddball other ones in there. Like you can have army worm, variegated cutworm, all these other things that
leaf miner
that are in there, right? That show up and in years like that where it's dry and the hay's not growing fast, then it becomes more of an issue. Then you really see that compounding effect because it's like, oh, I have all these different things here. I should probably do something. But
I think the biggest thing is, as a farmer, when you or your custom harvester get done cutting and you have all this on your cutter bar, it's not a point to panic.
Right. The world is not ending. The insects have not taken over the world.
It seems like every year I get that one call of the panic. But I do think there is some cumulative effect of two or three pests on one at a time. So I think that's something to keep in consideration when you are doing your sweeping. If you are at three-quarters threshold, I don't know even what that number is. Maybe it's half threshold for each. Insecticide isn't that expensive. It doesn't cost you a lot to do. Again, we don't want to be running out there for nothing.
Right.
That's not good IPM either.
Well, because you kill beneficials by right. just recreationally spraying insecticide.
And that was the big comment on the spittle bugs is they really aren't a problem because there's so many beneficials that take care of the spittle bugs. So if you're running out there, you might run the risk of actually doing more damage than good.
All right. Well, thanks, Bill. That's some things to think about when looking at alfalfa, and don't immediately panic if your cutter bar is crawling with bugs. Now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So GDM is looking to acquire AgReliant Genetics. That is a Argentine seed company. So AgriGold, LG Seeds, and Pride Seeds brand will have new ownership under acquisition agreement that was announced in late June. GDM, which is a global plant genetics company based in Buenos Aires, Argentina, with operations in 15 countries and a team of 3,400 employees, announced it would acquire 100% of the shares in AgReliant Genetics, which has provided corn, soybean, sorghum, and alfalfa seed in North America. In the press release, GDM stated that the strategic acquisition would bring together GDM's global scale, long-time reputation for world-class innovation and elite soybean genetics expertise with AgReliant's market leadership in corn breeding and genetics, strengthening GDM's portfolio of high-performing seed solutions for growers and underscoring its commitment to growth in the region. So AgReliant, which is headquartered in Westfield, Indiana, was founded in 2000 as a joint venture by KWS and Lima Grain. The company holds one of the world's largest North American temperate corn genetic pools and the fourth largest corn research program. So just more mergers. Just keep, seems like.
In some of these, as we lose companies, it's different. These that say some company that sells similar genetics to another one, and then they just sort of retire the old name. We got to remember that that's different than this, where it's a large merger of
yep.
of two companies. So hopefully, you know, as we can keep enough diversity, and hopefully too is some of these that like LG would be a good example of one that the, you know, has changed even in our area. That used to be, say, Great Lakes Seed was one that they kind of combined, that by doing this, we can, you know, make them better.
Yeah. No, it's always good to have a little bit more diversity in the gene pool as long as that maintains. So this acquisition is subject to regulatory approvals from the Federal Trade Commission and U.S. Department of Justice. But, yeah, along with other, you know, your normal business closing procedures. So the two companies will continue to operate as independent entities, maintaining their current business routines and commercial structures until everything is figured out and the transaction has closed. So we'll see what happens there. All right, now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. Since we were talking about alfalfa insects, why not talk about the tool that is very useful to us, but very confusing to onlookers, the sweep net. No, we are not just catching butterflies out in the field. The sweep net, which is an insect collecting device, has been around for at least 180 years. The earliest reference is 1835. There are a number of slightly later references in entomology texts and specific books from 1844, 1860, 1865. Instructions for their use are minimal, but they do exist. So there's a quote here from a brief description in an 1841 article. The same net or lighter one of similar form screwed on a similar or the same stick is called the sweeping net and is used for sweeping grass, which myriads of minute insects are always to be found. The weeds in the bank of the rivers and canals are also excessively productive in insects, which can only be taken in this manner. In walking through meadows, it will be found a good plan to hold this net in such a position that it may continually strike the projecting blades of grass. So I would say that it's pretty accurate way of describing a sweep net is you have to get it in contact with the crop you're sweeping. Otherwise, it doesn't really... Sweeping it through the air, like, which is, I think, what you see in movies and stuff for people chasing butterflies.
Right.
SpongeBob and his jellyfish, all those fun things. That's not really how we use them. We're more actually focused on not pounding them into the ground, but sweeping the crop, especially when alfalfa is short, right above the ground. So
I'm shocked at how old, like, that it's that long ago that they would have come up with this instrument for, obviously then it was as an entomologist to identify and look and all that kind of find bugs, but that's neat that it goes back that far, and that how they even describe like using the net or the bag out of muslin, which I believe the two choices right now on a sweep net are muslin or like a sackcloth, they call it, is sure. The one. But it's odd to me, too, that literally the technology is, which I don't know how much more advanced you're going to get in a net by any means, but yes, these are the same exact tool.
Right, it's not one that's changed a lot over the years.
Not at all. And you'd think you'd find even like a better material out of the net part. And no, muslin, I prefer the muslin ones. I know Bill has a lot of the sackcloth ones. What do you like, Matt, when you...
The sackcloth ones are heavier.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that, like it's, when you're walking, especially if you're sweeping a lot, it weighs down on you. As far as effectiveness, I don't find one better than the other.
The only reason is when they get wet.
Yeah, the lightweight
yes.
aspect of the muslin makes it a lot nicer to carry around. And
when it's wet, it just isn't like this big sopping, you know, like wet bag that you're carrying right. around. Whereas that other one... The sackcloth, when it gets wet, when you're in the morning sweeping with the dew, it
stays wet all day long. Yeah.
So. Oh, that's neat.
It doesn't seem to fly out of the truck bed as easily as the muslin ones, though.
Yeah.
Hopefully you remember to put it somewhere or weight it down, but it always seems to happen every year. Somebody, I know one of our coworkers this year already managed to lose a net either out of the truck bed or off a four-wheeler sometimes. They'll just go flying and... It's usually not the net that suffers, it's the handle.
Sure.
Get broken or
yeah.
get run over, or the ring gets broken. But yeah, so they've been around a long time, and yeah, not a lot of changes there, but still pretty effective. And, you know, there's obviously a technique to it that goes on to describe, they call it the figure eight, but, you know, which is the sweeping motion to get your best collection using your wrists. It sounds funny, but it is really kind of an art form. That's another thing that makes it kind of difficult to teach to scouts is you have to have them just kind of keep doing it until they get the rhythm down. So.
I agree. The sweeping motion it takes time to kind of get it figured out. Otherwise, you're just sort of like kind of going either too hard an angle down at the ground or too hard at the alfalfa seed. It takes some time to really get that really nice sort of sweep to it. Even holding the handle, like I tend to kind of one hand just sort of is a guy and the other one kind of turns it. So, and I like to hold it a little more upright than other people watching. Yeah.
Yeah. At this point, like I can't even tell you how I hold it. It's just such a, like a reflex action. No. Like you just go out and I sweep now.
What's wild is teaching my daughter how to do it this year. And like after she watched me do it the first time, she's like, how are you holding it? What are you, cause yeah, she had it like a different hand up and it's almost like when you hold a baseball bat or a golf club, you got a certain grip that's kind of more popular than the sort of what you teach kids. And yeah, holding the sweep net is like that. And you got to get that whole cadence down.
So yeah, that's a little bit of background on the sweep net.
All right. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. Just search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts or on your Android phone. Download an app like Podcast Addict. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcast. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll move into our Cool Beans That's Corny with some current events. So, Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Soy-based firefighting foam is implemented. The Nebraska Soybean Board recently participated in the Nebraska State Fire School Expo, collaborating with Cross Plane Solutions to inform fire departments about soy foam TF, 1122, a soy-based firefighting foam. The Nebraska Soybean Board distributed 15 sample pails at the expo to fire departments statewide and plans to provide additional samples to more departments later in the year. Soy foam TF1122 is designed to suppress fires effectively while prioritizing firefighter safety. It's 100% free of intentionally added per and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, and fluorinated chemicals, which are commonly found in traditional firefighting foams, made from soy meal and flour, byproducts of the soybean crush process. The foam is certified as 84% bio-based by the U.S. Department of Agriculture Bio-Preferred Program and is also certified biodegradable. So we've talked about it on the podcast before that they were developing it, but it's kind of cool to see they're to the point where they're trying to introduce it to fire departments. And so the foam also operates as a wetting and smothering agent capable of extinguishing both Class A, ordinary combustibles, and Class B, flammable liquids, fires. It works with existing firefighting equipment, requires no changes to standard procedures or additional trainings. The foam has demonstrated vapor suppression on various fuels and meets the National Fire Protection Association standard for wetting agents. Soy foam is also the only green screen certified gold firefighting foam in the world. So,
the world.
The world. So, yeah, it's kind of a cool, different use for some soy byproducts. So, be interesting to see where it goes. Our That's Corny this week. Del Monte Foods has announced Chapter 11 bankruptcy, including the pursuing new ownership. The company operates several fruit and vegetable plants, including one here in Wisconsin in Plover. So as of July 1st, they have begun Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings. The company's announcement, Del Monte Foods announced it would pursue a sale as process as part of its overall plan to restructure its debt. According to court filings, Del Monte Foods Corporation and 17 affiliated debtors filed voluntary petitions July 1st for relief under Chapter 11 of the U.S. Bankruptcy Code. The first day of hearings begins July 2nd. And in a company release, they said that the company determined a court-supervised sale process, which would be the most effective way to strengthen Del Monte Foods for the future, calling it a strategic step forward. So, yeah, it's unfortunate, but hopefully they'll be able to find someone who can keep all those folks working that work in the Plover plant as well as their other plants around the country. So now we'll wrap things up with our Field Good Friday. And we are now less than a month away from Clinton Farms, who are hosting the 2025 Wisconsin Farm Technology Days in early August. So it'll run for 3 days at Clinton Farms near Bear Creek in Wapaka County. Be a one-stop show mixing the newest farm equipment with farm practices and entertainment. Agriculture is a $116 billion industry annually in Wisconsin, and according to DATCAP, and this event will showcase latest equipment research and production practices in the industry. So Clinton Farms also hosted in 1978 and 2003. A six-year-old rotary parlor is one of the biggest changes to the farm's hardware in the past 22 years. They'll have had their media day about a month ago, and they'll be. I know they just talked to a couple of folks over that way. They marked out Tent City earlier this week. So you guys remember what that was
PTSD, like? PTSD, man.
Yeah.
So got all the booths and everything staked out. Tents are probably going up pretty soon. Equipment will start rolling in. So it'll be interesting. I know I'll be there probably all 3 days for the demonstration farms. We have a booth that we're doing. Yeah. So, yeah, be interesting. I haven't, to be honest, I don't know if I've gone since 2012 when we helped with Audi Gamies. So it'll be an interesting experience to see what's changed in the last 15 years. So
it is neat. They're like 13. A three-time host that they hosted in 1978 and 2003. Like, that's just really neat to have that.
Well, even for Wapaka County, that's where the first ones were held in Wapaka County.
Right. Too.
So it's kind of a...
It's a really good spot for it.
Yeah.
Like, I went... In 2003, I remember going with Jeff Plinsky at that time, and just be like, parking was nice. It was off the main highway, was nice. Like, it just was one of the most perfect sites for it. You had good roads in, good roads out. You're not near some city or some river that sort of hampers traffic, and yeah, it just worked really good. So encourage anybody to go, yeah, do what they can to help out and do what they can to even just to go and see it. So
yeah, they're they're always looking for volunteers, so if you're interested in helping out, you can look at the Wisconsin Farm Tech Days website and find out how to volunteer for the event. And yeah, big show. Hopefully they get good weather. That always seems to be the biggest linchpin in that show is what the weather's like, but all right, that'll do it for today. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about alfalfa pests and some of the thresholds that are needed to really make you need to go out there and do something about it. In our spotlight, we talked about the acquisition attempt by an Argentine seed company that's going on. Egg History Minute, talked the history of the sweep net. Cool Beans this week was... I don't even remember what the Cool Beans was.
Cool Beans? It was the soy foam.
The soy foam.
Yeah,
soy foam. That's Corny was the Del Monte Foods Chapter 11 bankruptcy and our Field Good Friday. Check out the Farm Technology Days at Clinton Farms in early August. Thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.